Hey everyone, it's Tom Thornton with Hedge Fund Telemetry, and today, late on a Friday, I'm very, very pleased to have Jim Bianco of Bianco Research today. Jim is an old friend, and I think he put out something earlier this week regarding inflation that possibly could be bottoming. That's not what people are thinking. They think inflation is still going lower. So, Jim, I just want to say thank you for being here. And before we say anything, Jim has an ETF now with WisdomTree. So Jim, tell us a little about yourself and the ETF.
Thanks, Tommy. So yeah, I'm Jim Bianco. I'm the president. I've been for 26 years the president of Bianco Research, which is an investment research firm, and our website is biancoresearch.com. Late last year in December, I did roll out an index called the Bianco Total Return Index, which is a fully invested fixed income index, and WisdomTree has an ETF that tracks it, WTBN. So anybody who invests in fixed income and is looking for bond market options, that's what we're presenting with our index that and the ETF WTBN. And it has a website called biancoadvisors.com if you want to take a look more about it. Or you can DM me or email me if you want ask me any questions about it. But thanks for letting me mention it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for being here late on a Friday. So, Jim, I'm going to go through, or we're going to give you some opportunity to go through some of the slides that you, or the tweets that, or Twix X that you had the other day. And I
Posts.
think they're really important. So, and at the end of this, we're also going to just do a quick talk about the bond market and the stock market and get your views on that. So, we've got about 12 slides. And then we'll talk a little about that and what we think.
So Supercore. Before I talk about Supercore, let me give everybody set the table with a big picture so everybody kind of knows that there's a big picture out there. Every time there's an economic stress point or a financial crisis, I think coming out of every single one of those, the economy and the markets, attitudes about the markets and the economy changes. And changes does not mean worse. It means different. So coming out of 08, and I'll just go back to 08, there was a bit of a retrenchment mentality that people had. I was worried about the future. I was worried about my personal finances. So when I saw that the stock market was rallying in 11, 12, 13, and I, keep the example simple, and I saw my brokerage statement going up and Zillow told me my house was worth more, I felt good. I felt good, but what did I do about it? I just felt good that I had more savings. But coming out of 2020, maybe it's PTSD or something else, I think to kind of personify it, people decided I want to live my life. So when they got stimulus checks in late 20 and early 21, they went on revenge travel. They went on doom spending. They speculated in meme stocks. They bought zero DTE options, zero data expiration options. They didn't plow it into super safe government money market funds and stock soup cans and worry about the end of the world. They said, damn it, I'm going to live my life. So what have we seen for the last 3 years? Higher levels of spending, higher levels of consumption, lower levels of savings. We call it revenge travel. We call it doom spending and the like. That is pushing more activity into the economy, and that is showing up as higher levels of growth, and that's putting pressure on interest rates. Understand what I'm arguing here is a change in mindset. Now, Wall Street recognizes this change in mindset, and they say it's excess savings. And once the excess savings runs out, in other words, what they're trying to say is no one's attitude about anything changed. We just gave them extra money. What I'm trying to differentiate here is no, their attitudes have changed. And if you give them $100 after the financial crisis, they spend 90 of it. If you give them $100 after COVID, they'll spend 94% of it. And that difference is why we're seeing extra growth and we're seeing higher levels of inflation. So I want to set the table that I have this big picture narrative that every financial crisis, every economic stress point produces a different result. This one will last until the next financial crisis or economic stress point, whether it's this year or in 10 years or whenever it happens, and then we'll change again. So that's where I think that the big picture is. Now, Supercore. The super core number is what the Fed likes to look at, and that is what that is that is core inflation ex housing services. So they take housing out, also take food out, they take energy out. Now you may say, I need a place to live, I need to fill up my car, I need to eat. Yes, but they're trying to look at what is left over. It's about 55% of the index that's left over. And by looking at super core, what Chairman Powell, this is an invention of his, is trying to make the case of, this is more sensitive to wages, is because if you look at the major categories of this black line on the chart shows you the year-over-year change in super core, and all the colored parts just show you the components of it. It's medical services, it's water, sewer, and trash collection, it's education, it's other personal, it's recreation services, transportation services. What drives the inflation among all of those things? The answer is wages is what drives it. So when it bottomed, if you look at the black line, at around 3.8% in October on a year-over-year basis, and it's moved up 50 basis points to 4.3%, there are alarm bells being set off at the Fed. Wage inflation is not disappearing on us here. Wage inflation is staying higher. And remember what it is about wage inflation, because a lot of people will say, what, the Fed doesn't want anybody to get a raise? No, they want you to get a raise, but what they're worried about is if you're getting a raise of 4% to 4.5%, then you can pay 3 to 4% inflation. So with wage increases comes the ability to pay more inflation. And that's what they're trying to show with Supercore. And with it moving higher and its monthly number in January being a big jump, it is very worrisome.
Okay, so that's something that a lot of people I follow have been talking about. A lot of people have always talked about how they like to strip out just about everything that in these measures, but this is very
Right.
important. So I put this chart out the other day. This is from the Bank of America Fund Manager Survey, and you also saw this one. And this survey was taken obviously before rates started to spike higher in the short term, and the inflation data from CPI and now today PPI moving a little warmer. Would
Yeah,
you?
what this chart shows, and again, this is from the February Global Fund Manager Survey put out by Bank of America. They survey about 250 global fund managers, and they run about $550 to $600 billion of assets. And it shows you in the chart that only 4% of these managers, so of 250 managers, we're talking 10 out of 250 or so, think that short rates will be higher in a year, and only 7% of them, so what's that, 15 to 18 of them
Right.
or so, think that inflation will be higher in a year. The rest of them think that that short interest rates will be at the same levels they are now or lower. And then, as the wording says, 90% of them expect lower short-term rates, and 77% of them expected lower inflation. So when we talk about inflation, let's talk about where the people that run money think it is. It's done. It's going down, and the Fed and all the central banks are going to cut rates. It isn't even a forecast. It's a statement of fact that that will happen in the future. That's how sure they are about this. And that's what makes it relatively dangerous if inflation were to be sticky, because money doesn't think it is anymore. And money is not positioned for sticky inflation or higher inflation. Let me restate that one different way. Money has already priced in lower inflation. So if, as we go through, and I'm going to make the case that inflation's not going to go down, like I say, if I'm wrong and inflation does go down, prices should be unchanged because it's already priced into the market. 90% of them think inflation's coming down. 77% of them think that short rates are going to come down. So they've already positioned themselves for that reality.
Yeah, I've been in the higher for longer type camp, and if you know, the thing that's really pretty amazing is that we've seen the on Bloomberg on the Warp page the Fed fund futures probabilities drop dramatically. Not, I mean, there's still I think 10% that think that March they're gonna cut. I don't know who those people are, but or who's doing that, but the thought is that, you know, May and June and July, those drop a lot. And I've been kind of thinking, well, if they, you know, if the Fed's going to cut, there's probably going to be some sort of problem with the equity markets down or the bond market dislocates or something in that realm. Or you have, let's say, some plumbing issue with the regional banks, commercial real estate. There's a lot of catalysts there. Or you have some sort of political issue, some war, terrorism, or something like that. So those are the things that I've always thought that the Fed is going to, you know, make a change. And usually when they do that, that lasts for, you know, a cycle. It's not the, you know, insurance cut or the, you know, the complementary cut, as someone said to me the other day. Oh, we're just going to complementary cut, you know, rates. At this point, I don't know if 25 basis points is going to do much. So let's this. Now
Yeah,
we're really getting into this.
if I could jump in real quick and just add to what you said, who's that 10% that thinks that March is going to go? That's crash insurance. That's all that really is that
Yeah.
it's a cheap option if, you know, something bad happens somewhere and we wake up to severely red markets and everybody breathing in a paper bag. I'll be glad that I bought that cheap option. That's really all that is. But realistically, it's really priced out of the market that the Fed's going to be cutting rates in March.
And this has been a Fed that's been fairly transparent as far as telegraphing what they're going to do well in
Right.
advance. So this is really now we're getting into the meat of some of the charts that I found pretty interesting.
So let me make a quick comment about Wall Street in general. Wall Street forecasts what it wants. Sometimes it gets that, but it rarely forecasts what it thinks it's going to happen. What does Wall Street want for the last couple of years? Lower interest rates. So a year ago, the forecast was for a recession. It never happened. Now we're forecasting a soft landing. And a quick, my cynical take on a soft landing. I know what a hard landing is. That's a recession. I know what no landing is. That is, you just continue, the economy just continues to grow at its potential, or maybe a little bit more. But what is a soft landing? Is it like a mild recession, or is it slower growth? It doesn't really have a definition. And my cynical take is it's the perfect thing for Wall Street to forecast, right? The thing that has no definition. Because I'll tell you, we are going to have a soft landing. Then in a year, I will define the soft landing so that I could tell you I was right at that point.
So
But
wait, one last thing. What did you think when Treasury Secretary Yellen said that she's believed, this was I think last month, that she believed that we have achieved a soft landing?
well, see, she could say that because it has no definition. So her definition of soft landing would probably incorporate, you know, that we're growing slightly below potential so that we could bring down inflation, everybody could continue to have a job, earnings can continue to go forward, and everybody's happy. It's the perfect outcome. Other people would define a soft landing as a mild recession. You know, not a major recession. So that's what I mean by you can say those words and then you can define them any way that you want to define them. So looking at this chart, what I've argued here is that Wall Street wants lower interest rates. We'll talk about why I think they want lower interest rates. And well, of course, we all know why, but we'll talk about why they want lower interest rates. So we've gotten inflation that was 9% in 22 down to 3%. And Wall Street coined this term, the last mile, to go from 3% to 2%. Now, on my handy Bloomberg machine, they do have a news trend function, and I typed in last mile and inflation to get a word count of how many times there's been news stories that include both the phrase last mile and the word inflation. And then on the top panel there, what I show is year-over-year inflation. And this is so typical of Wall Street. The year-over-year inflation rate bottomed to date at 3% last June, 7 months ago. We're at 3.1 now, but the low was 7 months ago. It was June when we invented the word. And what's so typical about Wall Street is first the event happens, and then when the event happens and it's over, that is, we got the last mile to 3%, then we invent a word for it and say it's about to happen. As you know, the old phrase goes, that's now casting. Now casting, to differentiate it from a forecast, is take something that just happened and now predict it's about to happen. That's what a nowcast is supposed to be. Well, that's what Wall Street's doing here. We just finished the big drop from 9 to 3 in inflation, and now we're going to predict that we're going to have a big drop in inflation. But it's already occurred. And so what I'm saying is the last mile talk started after inflation bottomed? And the answer is yes. So all this last mile talk has not w planned out because the low in inflation was June. Now, as we go through the next set of charts, I'll tell you why I think that that low in June might still hold. Maybe we'll get a 2.9 or a 2.8, but we're not going to go all the way down there. The chart you've got here is the monthly CPI numbers. And in red is the next 3 months. Now, we're talking about year-over-year CPI. That is the way that we look at inflation. And there is a thing called the base effect. And what the base effect is the February CPI, we know that we're going to get one. We're going to drop February of 2023, which is the first red bar, which was 4/10. And then we're going to replace it whatever February of 24 is when we get that number next month. And then we'll see how that impacts the inflation rate. And then we know that in March, it gets a lot easier. That's called the base effect because we'll drop a 1/10. Then we'll drop another 4/10 in April. And then it gets really easy to hold the level of inflation because we'll have a 1/10, a couple of 2/10, and then we're into the fall at that point. We're very close to the election. So the next potential to see the year-over-year inflation rate drop is in February at 4/10. But as the next set of charts come up, I'll make the case that we might see another 4/10 rise in February. And then we're into that period of very low numbers from a year ago that we never quite get below 3%. And month after month after month just keep going. And we don't quite get there. Maybe in April we get to a 2.9 or something like that. And then we come back to a 3% again, because then what we got to do is get better than 1/10 in May. And otherwise the year-over-year number starts going up. And Jay Powell's sitting there going, 3% inflation's unacceptable. We can't even talk about cutting rates at 3% inflation. And then the market starts to get frustrated because 14 to 15 weeks it was up. It was up on the idea, the S&P that is, on the idea that interest rates were going to come down because the Fed was going to cut rates. And we're not really seeing it. I know, Tommy, did you have a thought about this?
The thought, well, I think it leads me into this next one because I'm kind of watching this. I've been really focused on crude
Yeah.
and gasoline prices, and I jumped at this one that you had that I thought was really pretty interesting because I've been watching this as well, and in December and January, the average daily national average gasoline price of unleaded gas was pretty low. Now what's happening?
Yeah. So this is a survey done of all 15,000 gas stations by the AAA Motor Club. And it is going up. And over the last 10 days, the price of gasoline is up something like almost 5%. It's like
It's more. I
4.9%.
think it. I think I saw it from January's low,
Yeah,
7% this morning.
exactly. And you know, whether you take it from January's low or the last 10 days or whatever metric you take, you're only going to find in the last 2 years three or four instances where percentage rise was larger. The point being, this is a really big rise in gasoline prices. And gasoline prices for inflation matter at the end of the day because it's 3% of it's 3% of CPI. And it's very volatile, 5% in a week, you know, 7% since the January low. And if it's very volatile, that's going to be enough to give you your 4/10. And a quick comment before we jump to the next chart. Oh, but that's headline inflation. Everybody knows that the Fed looks at core inflation, and that's true. The Fed does look at core inflation, but the Fed can never say, you know, this core inflation number that no one understands, it's down, we're going to cut rates. You know, that number that says that we're still at 3% inflation and we're not at our 2% target, you can ignore that. It's all gasoline price rises. It doesn't matter. We'll have a revolution. If Jay Powell was to say, I understand the pump prices are going up every day, ignore that. We have no inflation. He can't. He can't. So if this number matters as much as his core inflation number, he needs to get this down. But gasoline prices are working against it to replace that 4/10 on the year-over-year number in February. And that's going to be a problem.
Okay, so this next slide, this was not yours, but I wanted to ask you about it because I think that when we look at the this is the PPI, and first thing I'll say is services keep driving this, and that drove it higher this last report. But the thing is, these green bars here and here, that happens to be energy. And I'm kind of in the thought of if energy prices start to increase, and I've been kind of saying that, telling people if WTI, which closed today at 79.19, moves above the 80 level into, the old big round number level, I think some alarm bells could start to go off, and that I think would be difficult for inflation going forward. So that's my thought here. Now, what, just give me your view on services and how strong services, and it's a big service economy, as we know. It's not manufacturing anymore.
Yeah, a
What do you
couple of
think?
things. You're absolutely right. So services, whether you're talking about PPI or you're talking about CPI, producers or consumers, services are about 2/3 of what we spend our money on. So it is always going to be the biggest part of it. And services are continuing to stay sticky. What's the biggest driver of services is wages. And
Wages.
so if you get sticky in services, you're getting sticky wages. Again, what's wrong with getting a raise? What's wrong with getting a raise? If everybody's getting a 4% raise, we can have 3 to 4% inflation. That's the problem. Or the average person is getting a 4% raise is what the problem is. But you're right. When you look past services, the blue part of the chart is goods. That's non-existent. The inflation there is non-existent. And then the green part of the chart is energy, and that's been somewhat negative. Now, this chart goes through January. As we saw with the previous chart, crude oil prices were 7% low, or I'm sorry, gasoline prices were 7% lower. Crude oil prices were about 10 to 15% lower in January. And you talked about whether or not we break 80. Well, we're at, 79, like 20 or so is what we closed on Friday. That's still the highest number since November on crude oil prices at this point. And so while the chart hasn't broken out, it's not that far away, as you pointed out, from potentially breaking out. We could see that early next week, if that's the direction that crude oil wants to go, and that it has been for the last couple of weeks, it's been the direction has been higher.
So this is your chart on monthly change in gas prices and the impact.
Yeah, it's like my worksheet. So the top panel is just the chart of the blue line is just prices. The red and green show you the average. The way that CPI calculates gasoline prices is it takes the daily average from the previous month towards the daily average of this month. Well, we're 2.7% higher through the 14th, so halfway through the month, we're 2.7% higher. If gas prices continue to stay at these levels and move higher, that will get bigger and bigger. The black line says that gasoline is 3.6% of CPI. So if you multiply the 2.7% rise by the 3% increase, what the green line shows you is it adds a tenth to CPI. It subtracted a tenth in January. And we still printed 3/10 on CPI, 4/10 on core in January with gasoline subtracting a tenth. Now it's adding a tenth, so a 2/10 swing. So getting my 4/10 number for February inflation to keep at a 3% year over year number looks doable unless we wake up next week and we see a big dramatic drop in gas prices and a dramatic drop in crude oil. But we haven't been seeing that with the trend and the momentum in it yet. You're looking at, like I said, 3% inflation for February. Then you look at between February and the election, you go, when's the next time crude oil is going to, or when's the next time inflation is going to drop? Well, unless you tell me that gasoline, I mean, excuse me, crude oil goes to $50 and that the economy implodes on itself, which means the stock market implodes on itself, because that would happen too. There isn't much opportunity to get lower inflation unless you just want to say in 90 days there will be a crisis that will implode everything. Okay, fine. Then we'll have no inflation. But short of that, if we don't get it in February, we're going to run out of time between now and the election, which is a nice way of saying no rate cuts. No rate cuts for the bulk of this year because Jay wants to cut rates. Jay Powell wants to cut rates. The Fed wants to cut rates. The Fed likes to say they're data dependent, but they're not getting the data to cut rates and they're running out of space. So what I'm trying to show with this chart is how I arrive at a 1/10 increase in the price of gasoline. And the bottom panel just shows you CPI, and you can see it goes up and down with gasoline prices because gasoline prices matter and they matter quite a bit.
And you don't have Biden having the ability to drain the SPR as well. Oh, so
Yeah.
that's
He's
in the past.
effectively drained it. Now, what I mean by effectively drained it is it used to have 700 million barrels in the SPR. Now it's got like 300 million barrels. And the estimates by engineering, the stories I've read by engineers that run the SPR is if you run it down below about 200 million barrels, you could go a little bit lower than that. You start damaging the ability to hold the pressure in some of the, engineering of the Strategic Oil Reserve. Now, you can run it down to zero if you want to, but then you've got it becomes enormously expensive to refill it because you have to do repairs on it for starters. So the point is, he played that card in 2022 when he drained the SPR. In an emergency, they could run down the next 300 million barrels to zero. Maybe his flagging poll numbers would be defined as an emergency, but I think what we really mean by an emergency is a war and like an embargo is what we would mean. You could run it down to zero, but then it would be expensive to repair it before you could refill it. But so effectively, there isn't a whole lot of SPR left to basically run down if the price of gasoline continues to go up. We played that card already.
Okay, so here's where we have a lot of debate among economists, and I think you have a lot of very good thoughts on shelter.
So the blue line, so the way that, let me back up, the way that the CPI calculates housing inflation is they have two measures. They have the owner's equivalent rent. Now, what they do is they take a survey of rents and they say, and then they put them into an algorithm and they calculate my house, which is not for rent, nor is any like kind of house in my neighborhood for rent. Same for everybody listening to us. What would be the rental price of my house versus a year ago? It's an algorithm that they do. And then they do the same thing actually for rents, but that's a little easier because they're surveying rents to do rents. The blue line is 24.5% of CPI, and that's housing inflation. Rental inflation is the thick orange line. That's 7%. So the two of them together are about a third of overall inflation. That's why OER, owner's equivalent rent, and housing or shelter inflation really matters. It's a big part. It makes sense. It's the biggest thing that we all spend our money on is our home. Now that peaked and it's gone down. Now, the last thing I'll mention so everybody understands, rents don't move that much. So when the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, measures a rent, they do 1/6 of their rental universe every month. So they survey all of their units twice a year. That's all they really need to do. Because, if I run an apartment building, what's my rent this? What are the rents in my apartment building this month? The same as last month, same as the month before. If I change them, I change them once a year. So they basically survey you twice a year. So they're not 11 months from your last change. So that peaked and it went down. And because they survey 1/6, everybody says that moves really slow. And so what you see on the line is some thin lines, which are more real-time measures of rents. Apartmentlist.com does one, Zillow does one, and then there's Case-Shiller's home price index. It's done on a year-over-year basis. Those things really rose a lot in 22 and 23, up 16, 17% on its peaks, and they've come down. Now, what everybody's looking at is they're saying, you see all those other measures of rents, and I've led them by 9 months, 14 months, depending on which one best fits the lead. But more importantly, what does it say is coming up? It's big drops in the real-time measures. So everybody says the OER and the RPR needs to fall and fall quite a bit in order to approximate what we see in market rents. So don't worry, that 1/3 of CPI is going to decline a lot. Now, remember that big mountain there of 16, 17%. If you jump to the next chart, I think that that's the wrong way to look at it. I think the cumulative increases is the same. These are the same measures. Just I'm looking at the cumulative increases. So from 2015 to 2020, you see the blue and orange line, OER and RPR. And the red line is Zillow. Zillow was right in line with them. And the Case-Shiller home prices ran a little bit above them, but not a lot above them. But what you've seen since March of 21, and maybe a little bit earlier, is we've opened up this huge gap. In other words, the market measures of home prices and rents are way ahead of what OER and RPR are showing. So what I'm arguing is we've understated the cumulative amount of inflation, and we need to have some catch up. What does that mean? That doesn't mean that OER and RPR necessarily have to go up. It's just that the declines that everybody thinks we're going to get, I think, are going to be slower. It's going to stay sticky. It's going to stay in that 6% and 5% year-over-year range, and it's going to hold up. It's a third of the index. It's going to hold up the whole index is what it's going to wind up doing. And so let me put all three of these together. The base effect, the numbers are going to get really small and easy to beat. Gasoline prices are at least for February going to offset that big number in February. You got another one in April, but that's it. After that, you've got a bunch of 1/10 and 2/10 inflation numbers, and we've been running with 2 and 3/10 inflation numbers for most of the last year. So if you offset February with higher gas prices and you have a low base effect and the OER, which is a third of inflation, stays sticky, I'm looking at the year-over-year number on inflation being 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, maybe 2.9 in there a little bit for most of the year. The last mile crowd wants to go from 3 to 2.0, if not 1.9, so they could beat Jay Powell over the head and say, cut rates, cut rates, cut rates. And if it stays at that 3 level all year, what you're seeing in the market over the last several months will continue. What is that? The Fed's going to cut rates in 3 months. That's what you've been hearing since the fall. And then what happens in 3 months? The Fed's going to cut rates in 3 months. And then what happens in 3 months? The Fed is going to cut rates in 3 months. When are we ever going to get to the Fed's going to cut rates next week? We never quite ever get there because the inflation rate never gets down enough to basically justify the next meeting, which is in 2 or 3 weeks, we'll finally get that rate cut. I don't think we're going to get there. Now, I'm not talking about rate hikes. I'm just talking about higher for longer. So I think what the Fed needs is they need lower inflation numbers. I'll remind everybody, and I've talked about this enough, I got to memorize. May 31st, 2022, Jay Powell went to the Oval Office. Sitting on the couch next to him was Janet Yellen. President Biden was there. And that was when the inflation rate was 8.6%. And the president literally pointed at Jay Powell and said, America, that's the guy that's going to bring inflation down. And since May 31st, 2022, Jay Powell has said, my job's not complete till we get to 2.0%. Not 2.9, not 3.3 or 3.1, 2.0. And that's why he's talking about not cutting rates, higher for longer, frustrating everybody at the last press conference, because he needs 2.0. And I'm arguing if he keeps seeing a three handle on inflation year over year, I don't care if they use core, there ain't going to be any rate cuts. Now, I could be
There's
wrong. Inflation could come down, it could be something.
people that have talked and argued that they should raise that to 3% as their target, which I think would ruin their credibility quite a
It not,
bit.
I would argue to you two things. One, you're right, it would ruin their credibility. I guess, look, I'm a middle-aged businessman. If you put the high bar at 7 feet and tell me to jump over it, I'd probably get 3 feet off the ground. I'll be 4 feet under it. You then don't tell me, okay, you've had two failed attempts. What do you want to do in the third attempt? Oh, let's raise it to 8 feet. Because you have to basically get it to 2% first. Then you could declare legitimate victory, and then you can then meet, talk about raising it to three. You can't just say, look, I can't high jump 7 feet, so let's move it to 8 feet. Because there's no credibility that I can get over the 8 foot any more than I can get over the 7 foot. The second thing to keep in mind, a little more nuanced, the Fed does a survey of consumer finances. The top 50% of income own 94% of the assets in the United States. That's stocks, that's bonds, that's houses, that's retirement funds like 401ks and everything else. The top 10% of income owns half the assets in the United States. The bottom 50% of income has over half the debt. So it's an unfortunate thing, right? Rich guys and women, they own stocks, they own homes, they have retirement plans. And when the stock market goes up, when interest rates go up, they don't own, they don't have debt, they get interest income. They're fine with higher interest rates and everything else. The bottom 50%, according to bankrate.com, they live paycheck to paycheck. They're hoping that their raise just keeps pace with inflation. They don't own stocks. They don't own a home. They have consumer debt, credit card debt, student loan debt. Maybe some of them have highly levered mortgage debt. So if you said 3% is the new target, you know, you bottom 50% that are living paycheck to paycheck, well, you better get a 3% or 4% raise just to keep up with grocery prices. And I'm sorry, your mortgage rates, your personal loan rates, your credit card rates, they're not coming down because the top half wants the 3% target because then the Fed will cut rates and the stock market will go up and they're happy, but the bottom half won't. One last thought for you on this. The top 50% of income is also about 90% of spending in the country. So they don't have a lot of debt and they watch the stock market go up and the housing market go up and everything else go up. And they spend, and that's why GDP stays strong. The bottom 50%, they don't have that luxury and they're losing. What makes this different is we have higher interest rates. You could argue we had the same thing in 2018, 2019 with the stock market going up. Yes, but we also had 0 to 2% interest rates is what we had. And we had 0 to 2% inflation. So that kept the bottom 50% in the game, whereas a 3% inflation target would not necessarily keep them in the game. So that's why the economy could stay strong because the rich spend it. But when you poll the president's approval rating or who you're going to vote for, it's one man, one vote. Jeff Bezos gets the same number of votes that somebody that's in the bottom 50% gets. And that's why the president's approval rating is down. And that's why the opposition candidate, Donald Trump, is running equal to, if not higher, than the president. So that's where the anger is showing up. That's where the disbelief is showing up about the economy, because you hear this, why do people disbelieve the economy? The numbers look great, because they're not in the top 10%. That it is fine for them. It is fine for the top 50%. But the bottom 50%, they tolerated it in 2018 because they had 0 to 2% inflation, 0 to 2% borrowing costs, and so they can make ends meet. But if you're going to just say, sorry, you need to deal with higher interest rates, and you need to deal with higher levels of inflation. Hope your boss gives you a 4 to 5% raise. Then that's where the anger is really going to come in. That's what's so different about this equation. So yes, if they want to go to 3% on their target, first get it under two. Establish that you can control this thing. Like first me jump high jump 7 feet before you move it to eight. And then second, once you've done that, then tell the bottom 50, don't tell me, tell the bottom 50% why it's in their interest to see inflation run a little bit hotter and to see interest rates run a little bit higher. And spoiler, you can't tell them it's in their best interest. And that's why it's
Yeah,
going to make it very
no kidding.
difficult. You know, that's why it's going to be very difficult for them to move it to 3%.
Okay, so then Nick Timiraos from the Wall Street Journal, the Fed Whisperer, or the current one, there used to be Greg Ip, and then I forget. Anyway, he's talking about PCE, and I want you, we've kind of dug through a lot of the inflation stuff, so I kind of want to go get through this so we can. We can have a few minutes and talk about the bond market, the stock market, and then we can wrap it up and we can head out. But
Yeah, so I'll make this real
PCE is on
fast.
the 28th, correct?
Correct. PCE comes out on the 28th. It uses the same survey that they calculate CPI and PPI from. So the raw data for PCE has already been released through the CPI and PPI data. So the propeller heads at all of these firms say, okay, now that I've got the raw data, PCE is just a different weighting, a CPI with some PPI thrown in there, I can make a fairly reasonable guess as to what PCE, core PCE, is going to look at. And what Timiraos is showing here is that on the bottom, the median forecast is, if you look at the month over month, is 0.4%, 0.41 to be exact. And so, like I said, the difference with the PCE forecast is we already have the data out. I know that, you know, the housing weighting is different in PCE, so I could change that weighting from CPI and I can make a fairly accurate guess. So if you jump to the next chart, I'll run this real quick, because this is the measure that the Fed looks at. Everybody's all enamored by this metric, the 6 month annualized rate of change of core PCE, PCE, personal consumption expenditures less food and energy, was 1.9%. Oh, the Fed hit its 2% target. 6 month annualized PCE. They're there. Paul Krugman has announced the Fed has already won the inflation battle because this metric is at 2%. Paul Krugman has said that, so that should be your warning sign right there. But here's the problem. If you jump to the next chart is the base effect for the 6 month, right? Not the yearly. So we're going to drop the July number. It was 0.1, and we're going to replace it with a 0.4. That is a reasonable guess that we're going to get a 0.4. That 1.9 is going to go to 2.2 or 2.3. In February, when we get the February number for the 6 month, we're going to drop the August number. That was an even lower number than July. We could wind up in a month with that 1.9% 6 month annualized CPI. And there's like three questions that people ask, Paul, you're 1.9 6 month annualized. Isn't that good enough for you to cut rates? That could be like 2.3 to 2.5 in a month. And then the answer is no, 2.3 to 2.5 is not good enough to even think about cutting rates. So the base effect could be kicking in and could be pushing that number higher as well.
Well, that kind of does it, but on your thoughts on inflation, I think it's important. I mean, I think the bond market, they say the bond market is always right. And the thing that also is sort of, we've seen this crazy speculation in the equity markets. And I somebody sent me this, and it's a sad reflection, but we've seen this story before. where this is from Wall Street Bets, and some poor guy put in $80,000 or something crazy into SMCI Supermicro options that expire today that basically went to zero. And he's begging Wall Street Bets to move this stock that's gone up 200 and something percent in the last month to go a little higher. And I think that it's just sort of indicative of the mentality in the market right now of this crazy speculation. Nvidia's up $650 billion in market cap, which is six and a half, six times their 2025 revenue consensus. It just seems to me like people are all in. They're all in on the, they've been all in on the Fed, and that's starting to weaken. But it's just we're at this speculative place right now. What's your thought?
I'm old enough and you're old enough to remember the period from 2009 to 2013. When we came out of the financial crisis, I don't recall anybody doing this kind of stuff or GameStop or zero DT. Zero DT, which is 0 days to expiration options, Goldman just put out a report. It's now over half of the options trading on the whole market right now. When you look at options trading, over half those options are being traded expire that day, and they relist them every day. That didn't exist a couple of years ago. Why? Because there wasn't an appetite for it. So this gets to my bigger picture that I said at the beginning. Coming out of the COVID pandemic, the attitude is one where I got to make a lot of money. I got to live my life. I want to buy a Lambo. I guess that's if you're in crypto, a Ferrari. I guess if you're in options, and so you see this kind of stuff. You weren't seeing this 10 years ago. So it really does go to a different mindset, and people might feel desperate. But 10 years ago, when they were desperate, they weren't gambling their life savings on a lottery ticket that expires at 4 p.m. Eastern. It goes to the mindset difference. And I really think what drove that mindset difference is what the Fed did in March and April of 2020, that I have to be in and I have to speculate. Because if you asked a lot of people, what is the job of the Federal Reserve chairman? They will tell you to make the stock market go up. I mean, Donald Trump used to rip him on Twitter all the time because he used to think that that was his job. Jay, your job is to make the stock market go up. And that's why you're seeing this kind of speculation. It's a byproduct of what we saw in March and April of 2020. He made the stock market go up. So now his job is to always make it go up. And my job is to speculate crazily that he's going to fulfill his job and I'm going to become rich. And unfortunately, like this guy is, doesn't always, it very rarely
Yeah,
works out that way.
it,
Most
you
of the
know,
time, it
it's
won't.
great. It's great until it stops working. And I've been kind of saying that it's not as, I mean, a lot of people call it a bubble that we're in, and maybe that's true. I think the bigger, better way of looking at it is sort of musical chairs type market where you've got this narrowness that's moving the market higher with fewer stocks and larger. I mean, it's different than, you know, the dot-com bubble, when you had a broader, everything was sort of everything garbagey was moving higher. But now it's like you're moving Nvidia up $600 billion in a 6 weeks, and you're moving these little tiny stocks that, you know, were small cap stock, and now it's worth four, it was worth $40 billion higher. I just think that you're kind of in this place where this ends bad, and it's a musical chairs market where there's fewer chairs. I mean, you got to take SMCI's chair, and that one's been removed in the game today.
Right.
And I mean, that's the risk.
Right. I mean, the risk is, even if you're a bull on Nvidia and you go, okay, the stock's up 220%, I could do simple technical analysis and tell you it could fall 40 or 50% and still hold its uptrend. But for you've lost half your money. And I don't know, if are you ready for that? And that's the problem is, are you ready for that? Yes. I'll call you when you've lost half your money And I'll let me see if you're still ready for it. And the answer is no, you'll be panicking. You'll be panicking that half your money is gone. And that's the problem. People say they're ready for it, but they really think it's going to correct 3%. And then it's
Oh,
going to go
that's
up
and then I can
80%.
buy more. Yeah, I
Right,
can get in.
exactly.
I
Yeah,
mean,
exactly.
that's been the hardest thing for me over the last year is we really just haven't we've seen this narrowness that's skewed the S&P and the Nasdaq higher, and haven't really seen the moving, really decent pullbacks. And that's fund managers buying every single dip and having that total confidence. And now you're starting to see several of the big Magnificent Seven fall off. And they're trying to rename it. But I think that Nvidia is maybe the one to watch this week because you have an 11% implied move. Now, an 11% move, if that's the what options are saying, and we're talking about a $1.8 trillion company, and that's you're if it went down 10%, that's 180 billion dollar market cap loss. Now everybody could say, well, that's moving it back to where it was in the beginning of last week or 2 weeks ago. That's a big number, and that could be even bigger if people say, let's take some of the profits that we have. We get scared, we take some off. The other thing that's really concerning to me is that the last two earnings reports from Nvidia, this was all about AI. They blew out numbers. Their guidance was raised like brilliantly, like, oh my God, it's huge. And the stock still sold off after earnings. In July, it went down not over one day, but it went down about 22%, which is substantial. And then 10% in November went down, almost 9% went down. And that, I think, is the thing. And a lot of people will say, well, I'll just get out if I, if it goes down, I'll get out. But, everybody's going to say that and hit the sell button at the same time.
So I got a question for you about it, and I'll express it is, what do you think about the parallels to 25 years ago with Cisco? And for everybody, 25 years ago was the internet, and everybody was all ablaze about that the internet was going to change the world. They were right, it did. And they had this idea, you got to do the picks and shovels play. You got to play the hardware maker of the internet, and that was Cisco. And Credit Suisse back in 1999 said they'd be the first trillion-dollar company. And they got to this insane valuation by the spring of 2000. And here we are 24 years later, and they're still not at that 2000 peak.
Yeah, they never made a new high.
Now,
I have
NVIDIA
some thoughts.
is the pick and shovels play of AI, right? You don't know who's going to be AI, but you want to buy the chip maker, just like you wanted to buy the server maker, and you wanted to buy the switch maker, which was Cisco, which ran to an insane valuation. In other words, I've seen this movie. I saw this movie 24 years ago, and I know how it ended 24 years ago. Am I wrong in that? What's your thoughts on it?
Okay, so I actually that's I have a great clientele, and one of my clients is a former AI or AA, not AI, institutional investor, number one rated telecom analyst. And he's just a subtle guy, really. He's in wealth management now, just a fantastic guy. And he said there are three layers to, I'm going to kind of get through this as quick as possible. There are three layers to the similarities to the dot-com bubble. You had the picks and shovels and those, the Ciscos, the Nortels, which are no longer, Lucent was there no longer, Ciena. Those were the picks and shovels. They built the internet and everybody was, jamming into those. And they were making a lot of money at that time. Now, the difference between Cisco, there's an analog out there that I posted that looks very similar as far as the move higher. And analogs are for fun and, games to watch. But they kept making a lot of money. And Cisco, I think they just came out with earnings, and I think their revenues were $50 billion, something just absurd. They still make a ton. And their valuation's a lot lower. But the next layer were the companies that were buying that stuff. And those were the CLECs, the phone companies, the ones that were selling the internet, that stuff. So they were buying all the switches and routers and everything. And the thing that's interesting is that those companies today are the AWS, the Azures, the data centers that are buying every single NVIDIA chip and set that they could get. And then there comes a time where that you build it out, the data centers are full, they've got all the stuff, there's double ordering, so the sales start to come down and chip equipment makers are ramping up production. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, wait, we're going to get some canceled orders here. But this is what I thought was so interesting. He said, I don't know, and we don't know the companies that are going to be the true beneficiary of AI. Where are the companies that are going to monetize the use of AI? Sort of like the companies that monetize the use of the internet. Now, Amazon went up 6,300%, a couple wiggles here and there, and dropped 93%, and then they figured it out, and everything was fine. Priceline was similar. Now it's booking. It went crashing down and it's ripped higher. I mean, you go back and you look at the long-term charts and they're just extraordinary. But we really don't know the companies that are going to make the true money by using that AI. And that's the next big thing that I'm going to be looking for. And I think all of us are going to be looking for. Now, who's going to monetize that? Now, you have Adobe that have said they're going to do that, but you really haven't seen it in earnings yet. And even Microsoft, they really haven't seen it with their Copilot. You haven't seen the revenues. Some people are pushing back on it. And then there's going to be companies like Alphabet that are going to probably give it away for free, or Apple that give it away for free just to get people staying with them. So I think it's still too early, but I hope that is that a good explanation?
Yeah, I know it's a fantastic explanation. I want to add to your third part, and I want to go back to the parallel from 25 years ago. Early on in the 90s, when we were told about the internet, you needed a big company to offer you a monthly service to get on it, right? We were all on AOL, we were all on Prodigy, we were all on the early levels of Yahoo. But what really made the internet take off is when we decentralized it. In other words, you and I could go get an email account for free, and we could create a website for free, and we could create tools to use on that website for free. And then we got the companies like YouTube, because YouTube, Google, Facebook, they didn't exist in 2000. They used those free tools in order to make social media, video streaming, search, and everything else that made them what they are today. So today, what I've argued bluntly is, if we think AI is going to be that you have to pay a monthly service to a $1 trillion company like an Amazon, like an Apple, or a Google to get access to AI, it will never fulfill its promise. But once it becomes, it's there, it's out on the internet, go get those tools. It's tools. And I can use those tools to create things with those tools without having to pay a monthly service to these big companies, then it will fulfill its promise. So, as I said to everybody says, we got, the winners are going to be Amazon, the winners are going to be Microsoft. No, they're not. They can't be. We're going to have hundreds of millions of people on bended knee giving them a monthly service and then allowing them to decide what I can and can't do. And I violate their terms of service and I can't do this and that. It is going to be this free Wild West thing. We're not there yet. And when we are, the companies that are going to monetize it and make it take advantage of it don't exist. They will then have the ability to create something. Besides, if I tried to make an AI company right now and a monthly service on Azure or a monthly service in AWS, they're going to charge me so much money eventually because of my usage that I won't ever be able to become profitable. So I think that that's really where we have to go. That's the missing part, is that I don't need Microsoft, Amazon, or Google to use this
Yeah, I think
AI product.
that thought is exactly right. Okay, listen, I've got to jump. Jim, thank you. Bianco Research, please tell everybody your ETF again.
WTBN, Wisdom Tree Bianco, N for Nancy. It's a fixed income fund at Bianco Advisors. There's more information on it. And I really enjoyed the discussion to talk
Yeah,
about
it
the
was great. We
markets
should do
and to
it. We'll
talk
do it
about
again.
inflation. I
We'll do
will
it
do.
again.
Thank you.
All
All right,
right.
bye-bye.
Have a great weekend. Thank you, everybody.